Greetings and welcome to this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Lauren Gibbons, Jacob Kanzler, and John Ruink. We have a special guest this week, Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest. Thanks for joining us, Adrian.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Kyle.
We're going to have Senator Mike Green on a little later in the podcast. John was able to catch up with him in sunny San Diego.
Sunny San Diego, talking about a balanced budget amendment, something he's very excited about.
Now that I've got my head clued back into non-Mackinac Island mode, we can talk a little bit about ballot proposals. Jacob, it sounds like you guys were heavily involved into taking a look at the various ballot proposals that could be appearing in 2016. You guys counted up to seven possibilities.
Yeah, well, at least more than seven. We had a couple under the medical marijuana thing. You know, after the corporate income tax hike proposal that came out on Thursday, you know, our colleague Craig had the idea to gather all these up in one place, especially since some have been around floating for a while. You know, you think of like the stop overcharging effort by Rocky Rakowski. So, yeah, we got them all in one place. So you want to check them out in the edition to see where they're at right now.
Now, Adrian, you were able to count up a few different ballot proposals than maybe we had listed in the edition. But before we kind of go through all maybe the second tier and third tier possibilities, I wanted to get your insight as somebody whose business is trying to mobilize grassroots, which is very important when you're dealing with ballot proposals. Based on your expertise, based on what we're seeing right now as far as folks talking about ballot proposals, what is the most likely thing we're going to see on the ballot?
I think we're certain to see some sort of marijuana initiative on the ballot, and I think it's going to pass. The question really is which one ends up on there. There are three different groups out there currently trying to put a marijuana legalization, decriminalization initiative on the ballot right now. So the first question is, who's most likely to make it? I think that the two groups you look at being most likely to get on the ballot are there's one group that's led by Jeffrey Hank, Ingham County attorney, who's been very involved in marijuana issues. That one's got a little bit more of a grassroots left-wing feel to it. The other one is on the consulting side, at least, being handled by Matt Marsden, former political staffer for the Senate Republicans. This one has a little bit more of a business tinge to it. Marsden is telling people that they either have the signatures or are very, very close. It sounds like they're a little further ahead of the Hank group in terms of organization. They've already got approved ballot language, so they're a little ahead of the game in those terms, and I think they've got a little bit more in terms of money supporting that initiative. The flip side of that is there's a lot of real grassroots organizing going on with the Hank group. It just remains to be seen if they're going to be able to raise the funds and have the campaign organization that they're going to need to get to the ballot. And we could end up in a situation where they both make it, which would be extremely interesting. But I think regardless of which of these marijuana petition efforts ends up on the ballot, we're very likely to see whatever it is pass.
Now, in speaking with the Bureau of Elections, they say that if both ballot proposals make it on in November, it's the one that has the most votes when it's all said and done that will actually take effect and become law. Now, Jacob, you were able to talk with some folks on this marijuana thing. Your sense is that the Marsden group actually does have some money and will be able to make a push to get the signatures in that way.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't want to disclose their exact number publicly ahead of the campaign finance today, but they're confident in the amount they have right now. You know, they believe that they're collecting signatures way quicker than they expected. They think they were. So,
now, Lauren, why does it seem like we've kind of moved to that direction? Do you think the public is ready for legalized marijuana?
Well, we've seen it in a few other states, and we've seen it pretty successful in other states, at least in terms of a tax. You know, obviously those states that already have it are making quite a bit of money off of it. You see Colorado as one example. And I think a lot of people, you know, have expressed the interest in saying, well, there's some revenue that we're missing out on. And so maybe that's where some of the impetus is coming from. And it's just one of those issues where maybe people are saying, you know, well, there are bigger things to be concerned with.
And why not just smoke the pot for the roads, right?
I actually want to, you know, Adrian mentioned there are three groups out there. I want to get your take on the third one, the Michigan Responsibility Council. You got to read on what they're going to do. I mean, I've talked to Paul Welday. They're kind of sitting back, watching everything. What's your take on how serious they are in terms of ballot proposal-wise?
My concerns with that group are two. Number one, they haven't done as much work, frankly, as the other two ballot groups have done. I mean, even even saying that the Hank affiliated group doesn't have approved ballot language yet, they're out there doing the grassroots organizing, trying to create a grassroots movement around this issue. I don't see that happening with the Weld Aid group in terms of the work on the ground or the ballot language. The other thing, of course, is that the language that they're talking about is very much tilted towards, oddly enough, the people who are funding the ballot initiative. Those folks would make out very, very well in terms of being the only folks that could actually produce and distribute marijuana under that proposal. And so
they'd be establishing a monopoly, kind of, wouldn't they?
They would essentially be establishing a regulated monopoly, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that per se, depending on your sort of ideological take on it. If you think that that's the way that the marketplace should operate for a particular good or service, but I don't think that that's very helpful from a messaging perspective when you're trying to get millions of people to vote for something, to, in addition to having to clear the hurdle of explaining why marijuana should be legalized, you have to clear that other hurdle of explaining that not only should it be legalized, but we should have a regulated monopoly to determine who's allowed to make money from this.
And that's really what this is about. It's as if the writing is on the wall that marijuana is going to be legal at some point. So who's going to be the first one who puts that regulatory framework in place and is able to get something out of it?
That's right. And it's very much creates barriers to entry for other folks who might want to break into the business, whether on the growing or on the processing side or any number of other angles that you could potentially make money off of legal marijuana. So, like I said, it just creates an additional messaging hurdle for that group. So I would, if I were ranking the order of likely success for these, you know, I would put the Marsden affiliated group first. I'd put Jeff Hank's group second, and I'd put Paul Weld's group in third.
So after marijuana, what do you think is the next subject most likely to appear on the ballot?
I think there's a very good possibility that we'll see something around gay rights on the ballot, and that could be from either direction or both. You know, I think that there is a good possibility that you see some sort of Elliot Larson expansion put on the ballot, with the caveat that, you know, the groups that would be in favor of something like that are very concerned about what happens if it does not pass. And so I think you're likely to see something, but not until those groups are very confident that it is going to pass. They don't want to deal with the consequences of losing at the ballot, which I don't think that they would. But I think the general sort of feeling amongst political professionals is that they would win, but that's not probably enough to stake that on. They need to go out and do some really high quality polling to make sure that they're going to win before they put that on the ballot. On the flip side, there is definitely a chance that some more conservative religious groups could try to do a RFRA initiative. You know, particularly if they went the voter initiated law route, much like the Associated Builders and Contractors and folks are doing with prevailing wage repeal, that they could probably pass that through the legislature and cut the governor out of it. So I wouldn't be surprised to see an effort at something like that as well.
Now, if we had something along those lines, that would potentially be a benefit for who, Republicans or Democrats? Or would it be really kind of a mixed bag?
I think it would be a mixed bag. I think it would favor Republicans, certainly in terms of giving Republicans another arrow in the quiver to try and draw religious conservatives out to the polls. So I think that on balance, it probably helps Republicans more, but the water's a little muddy there.
The third thing, what's the third most likely thing to appear on the ballot?
Well, you're shooting right up the list since they just announced this last week. I would put the CIT for Roads proposal at number three in terms of possibility of passing. Saying nothing about the policy behind this, this is pretty good politics. It's much better politics than Proposal 1 because it's simple. Right. It's very easy to understand. We're going to raise the corporate income tax by 5 percentage points, and we're going to devote that money to the roads. Very simple and clean to understand. It's got a little bit of a populist flavor to it in that, we're going after the big guys. You know, the little guys have paid their fair share. We're going after the big guys. I think it's much cleaner from a messaging perspective in that regard as well, with that sort of populist tinge to it. The other thing about it is there's a feeling among some, I don't think we're quite at this point yet, but we may be approaching it, that the only way you're going to get new revenue for the roads is at the ballot box, that this legislature may be incapable of producing new revenue, you know, a package of new revenue that can actually pass both chambers and be signed by the governor. I don't think we're quite at that point yet, but the closer and closer that we get to the election next year, you know, that point is fast approaching. So I think that's the other thing that this proposal has going for it. The other thing to keep in mind here is that there's a possibility for this to get negotiated away. The groups that are, you know, that were there in support of this at the press conference last week are all building trades unions. And they've obviously got some pretty hot issues in the hopper right now, starting with prevailing wage repeal. And we can talk about prevailing wage repeal more in a little bit, but there's a chance that this could be negotiated away to make the prevailing wage repeal issue go away, particularly given the chances of that actually passing if it made it to the ballot, prevailing wage repeal.
Well, that's a good point here, John, because this would be the business community's worst nightmare, right? The Republicans can't come up with a road funding plan. So this would become a fallback and something the voters could say, you know what? I'm not going to get taxed by this. Go ahead and let's tax businesses. Snyder's giving these guys a good enough break.
There's going to be a lot of maneuvering to make sure it doesn't get on the ballot, because I think there would probably be a lot of concern in the business community that the option would be there to enact it. The question I have for you, Adrian, though, is if you're Representative Townsend, how does this fit with his proposal, his idea about a progressive income tax? If they were both made it, how would that fare? How would they impact one another?
There's definitely the possibility of overdoing it on the soak the rich rhetoric, right? You know, some good populist messaging is generally going to be pretty good for Democrats, economic populism, but it's very possible to overdo that. I mean, the voters in general, even your sort of swing voters or Dem-leaning voters, do understand that there's, you know, there is such a thing as marginal tax rates being too high, and I'm not here stumping for Arthur Laffer or anything, but there is such a thing as marginal tax rates being too high, and so you could overload the ballot if you had both of those things on there at the same time. Back to the point about this being the business community's worst nightmare, that's only partly true. Right? Only C corporations pay the corporate income tax. Like my company, for instance, is Grassroots Midwest Incorporated. I don't pay the corporate income tax. Right. Most companies in Michigan don't pay the corporate income tax. Now, there are some business groups. The Michigan Manufacturers Association seems like an obvious one, since they have big manufacturing companies that are going to tend to be C corps. They would get brutalized by this, and they would obviously be very opposed. Chrysler's an obvious exception. Right. But most of your large manufacturing concerns are going to be C corporations, but there's going to be some split within some of the big business trade associations, like a Michigan Chamber of Commerce or SBAM. You know, some people just wouldn't be affected by this, and they may be willing to help out with money, you know, time and treasure in solidarity with their brethren, but there's only so deep you're going to reach into your pocketbook to fight something like this off if it's not going to directly impact you, which I think was, you know, one of the smart things strategically about this from the perspective of the people that want to put it on the ballot is there's an element of divide and conquer going on here.
But let's talk about the carpenters and the people who are behind this. Do they have the political oomph to make this happen, either with money or organization?
Not by themselves, but I don't think that the idea is for them to do it by themselves. I mean, to answer your question directly, no, by themselves they do not. It's three of the larger building trades unions in the state, so they've got plenty of political oomph. You know, where that's going to be most useful for them right now at this stage is bringing additional allies on board. If they're able to bring some other allies on board from organized labor, from some social welfare groups out there, that even if they can't contribute with money, can contribute from a messaging and organizing perspective, then they could very well get there. They're in organization building mode right now, which is entirely appropriate. That's where they should be.
Question on the prevailing wage. There's obviously the anti-prevailing wage group has formed, is collecting signatures, all that. The pro-prevailing wage has formed a committee. Do they do a counter-ballot proposal? Are they just going to raise money to spend against the anti-prevailing wage, or both? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the best place for the folks who want to preserve Michigan's prevailing wage law to win is in the legislature. I mean, my understanding right now is that the House Republicans do not have the votes to pass prevailing wage repeal in the House of Representatives. If that continues to be the case, and I don't think it gets any easier to scare those votes up as you get closer to an election, if that continues to be the case, then you know, I think you'll see the folks that are organized against this spend most of their time and effort keeping the legislature locked up and messaging messaging against prevailing wage repeal. If this does get kicked to the ballot, which it might very well, then they'll certainly start spending money there, and I think that they're very likely to win. I mean, it's hard
for
me.
Who's likely to win?
I think the folks that want to preserve the prevailing wage law are very likely to win at the ballot box. It's difficult for me to see how you would pass prevailing wage repeal in a presidential year with what turnout is likely to look like. Particularly up and down the I-75 corridor. Even a lot of swing voters, voters who will end up voting for some Republican candidates, are very unlikely to support prevailing wage repeal over there. It's a lot of shop people. They may be pro-life and pro-gun, you know, a little more socially conservative, but they're very unlikely to support something like this, those inconsistent voters that'll be coming up and down the I-75 corridor and to a lesser extent, you know, there and back on I-94.
Let's kind of buzz through these. The fourth most likely thing to make it on the ballot.
I think some form of redistricting reform is what I would rank number four.
Now, who's going to put that together? Is that the Democratic Party or...
Well, and that's a very interesting question. If it's just the Democratic Party and Dem-affiliated interest groups, I think it has a harder time.
Right.
If they can get some other folks on board with this, which I think is entirely possible, then I'd put that pretty high on the list for something that could pass, particularly because there's very easy, very simplistic messaging that can be taken out to the voters about the voters being able to choose their representation instead of the other way around.
Well, that's certainly a possibility and something that the Democrats definitely want to see on the ballot. What would you say is the number five most likely thing to make it?
You know, I think the paid sick leave piece is another one that you could see make it to the ballot. I've got serious questions the further we get down this list, but from them, you know, they've got the populist messaging, check. Hated by business groups, check. No real funding to speak of, also check. Very much like what we saw with the minimum wage piece, you know, not so long ago.
And they still put it on.
They did, and they ended up getting, they ended up doing quite well, depending on how you look at it, in negotiations. And then with the sort of end around that the Republican legislature did, they did get an increase in the minimum wage. It wasn't what they wanted. So if this doesn't go to the ballot with some national funding, I wouldn't be surprised to see something like that develop. Okay, at number six, I've got some sort of renewable energy proposal. This is dependent on how the debate around the state's energy law goes over the rest of this summer into the fall, depending on when that gets done. You know, there's been attempts in the past to do some sort of, you know, renewable energy proposal. I know Byram and Fisk were very involved in that last time, and I wouldn't be surprised to see something similar. I know that there are some funding groups out in California that are still very interested in doing something like that in Michigan. If the money's there, you'll see something on the ballot.
Well, we couldn't do a constitutional amendment. We tried that in 2012. That got beaten pretty good. Energy law that is passed by the legislature, if that doesn't include a renewable portfolio standard, maybe something that would just be added on to that in state laws as opposed to a constitutional amendment.
You could certainly see something like that. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
All right, let's move down your list. Number seven.
Number seven, and this is sort of a catch-all, is some other sort of roads proposal. If the CIT for roads thing doesn't go, you know, along the lines of the point I made earlier, I don't believe that we're at the point yet where folks are ready to wash their hands of a legislative solution. But the closer we get to the election next year, the more likely I think that is, that, you know, the major interest groups out there that want to see road funding would try to go to the ballot with something else. Hopefully they have learned some lessons from their perspective from how Prop 1 went. Not that that was the solution that they wanted, but certainly they should try to avoid all of the many pitfalls that afflicted Proposal 1, starting with simplicity of message. I mean, that's the thing that the CIT for Roads thing has going for it, is a very simple message. And if you're not going to do that, it has to be something clean like the sales tax or the gas tax.
Obviously, the road building associations wouldn't want to put some more money behind a ballot proposal. Seems like they've kind of been there, done that. So it would have to be some other group. Moving down the list.
Absolutely. Number eight, I've got a wild card. So I've been talking to a number of interest groups around the political scene here, and there seems to be some appetite for potentially a constitutional amendment to shrink the legislature after the next redistricting.
Oh, wow. We're not talking unicameral here, are we?
No, we're not. What we're talking about is essentially shrinking the House of Representatives from 110 members to 80 members, shrinking the Michigan Senate from 38 members to 25 members, packing them all in the House office building, and that would all take effect after the next decennial census when we redistrict. That's got some very, very interesting possibilities, and there does seem to be some real appetite for that with some folks out there, both on the business and on the more left-leaning side.
What are we going to do with those new offices at the Bossier?
It's a fine question. We won't need them, I guess, is the short answer, which will certainly disappoint at least a couple of people, but I think in general...
For the press corps, what do you think?
I think that would be fine. Absolutely.
Okay, now, I wasn't expecting this one. So where's the who's talking about this? What kind of details can you give us on this? I haven't heard this before.
Well, so there have been... We have talked to a number of business groups that have expressed some real interest in this. You know, some of the more traditional mainstream type of business groups that have expressed interest in this. We've also talked to a couple of labor unions that have thought that it's not the the worst idea to shrink the legislature. There's a feeling amongst people that deal with the Michigan legislature that it's gotten really unwieldy and difficult to deal with, especially in the House of Representatives, and that this could help with some of that. So I wouldn't be shocked to see something like that. It's further down my list. There hasn't been a formal group formed around this or anything. I think they're just taking folks' temperature right now. But I wouldn't be surprised, particularly if the road funding piece continues to linger with no real action on it, if a bunch of groups don't just throw up their hands fine.
So beware, lawmakers, if you don't fix the roads.
Yeah.
This might be coming.
I mean, I think at a certain point, the lawmakers are going to start to feel this. I mean, there are a number of different levers that interest groups have to make lawmakers feel pain. One is obviously money. Two is the sort of issue advocacy, against them on particular issues in their districts. But, some real structural reform, if you make these interest groups mad enough, they may just say to hell with you.
But there would be no other reforms like extending term limits or part-time. It would just be shrink the size.
That certainly hasn't been brought up in any sort of seriousness in the conversations that we've had. Some folks have brought it up just in a questioning manner of, well, would you include this? Would you include that? But the real appetite for this seems to be, look, we have enough trouble dealing with these guys right now. There's way too many of them. Let's shrink them down and maybe they become a little bit more manageable and a little bit more representative.
Interesting. Okay, real quick, let's go through the last ones.
Okay, so,
after, number nine?
Number nine, I've got prevailing wage repeal.
All right. We hit on that.
I don't see that passing at the ballot. If the legislature can get it done, it'll get done. If they can't pass it through the House, again, I don't see how you pass that with the additional turnout up and down I-75 and to a lesser extent 94.
Number 10?
Number 10, I've got a fracking ban on here.
Oh, yeah, the old fracking friends here.
Yep, the number 10 is the fracking ban. The problem here is that this is mostly being pushed by some fringe environmental groups. A lot of the large institutional enviros are not particularly interested in a complete ban, moratorium. There's no real money behind this to speak of. It's opposed by virtually every, semi-interested business group under the sun. If somebody got interested in this outside the state and really wanted to push it, it could potentially go. But as it stands right now, I don't feel like the environmental groups in Michigan, the big institutional players, want to put the money behind this to make it go. But it's still hanging out there as a possibility. And that's my top 10 list.
Very good. Very good. Adrian Heeman, he's with Grassroots Midwest. Thanks for joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks again for having me.
You were able to speak with Senator Green during the ALEC conference about his ideas to have a balanced budget constitutional amendment convention.
Yes. Remember we passed it. The state actually made its application for a balanced budget amendment. It's in front of Congress. I spent some time talking to one of the advocates behind that whole movement. He contends there are only 30 lawmaker votes across 9 states away from actually making this happen next summer. And I talked to Senator Green about some of the concerns conservatives have about a runaway convention and how do you control a runaway delegate.
All right, well, let's listen to that interview and find out.
I've got a special guest with me, Senator Mike Green from Michigan. We're at the American Legislative Exchange Council in San Diego, California. It's beautiful here, but it's not as beautiful as Michigan, is it?
I don't know what the weather is there. But it's pretty nice here.
I wanted to talk to you because one of the topics the last 2 or 3 days and something that ALEC has always had an interest in is the balanced budget amendment. Now, I was talking to a gentleman who is part of a coalition that is backing the balanced budget amendment. He says he believes they're only 30 lawmakers away from getting it passed. But he said he thought Michigan had something else that they could still do to solve something called the runaway delegate. What is a runaway delegate?
Well, it's more of a runaway convention when the delegates all come with the interest of passing one issue, and they take it over and pass a number of issues. And that's been the fear with a balanced budget amendment, is whenever we have a convention of states, of what is the convention going to do, and can they just hold it to one issue? That, in and of itself, is what's holding some states back, not the fact that they don't want the federal government to have a balanced budget, but they're just really concerned about a runaway convention.
They're afraid it's going to turn to guns. It's going to turn to all sorts of different things.
Everything, yeah, taxes. There's no ends of things that they're worried about. Mm-hmm. Privacy Act is a lot. Freedom of speech. I mean, all of the things that we have now and cherish and hold dear could be changed if we did have a convention that wasn't limited.
Okay.
And that's what this is, limited.
So Michigan has submitted its application for the balanced budget. What else has to happen? And what are you doing about runaways?
There's not much I can do. I introduced a resolution in 2013 to create a balanced budget convention. It was passed the Senate and the House, and it was sent to Congress. The governor did not have a role in it. The states that have passed that, they've all sent theirs to Congress. When Congress gets 34 states, then they will call a convention. And there's still questions about will they. Even though the Constitution says they will and they have to, you know and I know the Constitution is getting obliterated in Washington right now. So the question is, will they even call a convention?
Boy, that would be an interesting news story right there, wouldn't
it? Yes, it would.
Yes, it would. Some states apparently have gone so far on the runaway issue, if we do have a convention, that I believe that Georgia's one. I think that I was told there's five. Four of those states, it would be a felony. If, for example, you were the delegate and you got to the floor of convention and just the idea of amending the Constitution took you away and you started voting for something other than the balanced budget, it would be a felony. You could spend 5 years in jail. Is that something Michigan needs to do?
Well, we did have a piece of legislation after the resolution was passed that delegated who the convention goers would be, and there was a lot of rules in that, not quite that strict. But the fact that the delegates that are chosen, and they were chosen, not elected in that piece, would have to adhere to certain rules. The governor vetoed that because he said that he felt that a greater proportion of people should determine who went to the convention. The bill said governor appoints one, speaker appoints one, and he just felt it ought to be broader than that, so he vetoed it. So I'm kind of letting the dust settle on that, and I'm going to reintroduce another bill. Not sure yet what it is and how it's going to entail, but work with the administration and see what they feel they'd be comfortable with, and then we need to get that done, and I'll work on that this fall.
Okay. There's a lot of folks who suggest it should be one state, one vote. Have you looked at that? What are your thoughts about it?
Absolutely. That's what it should be.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of being able to get to that point. That way, if you've got eight delegates, and all the states, their laws will send different amounts of delegates, but in the end, there should only be one vote from every state. I firmly believe that's what I'm going to hope we can get done in Michigan.
Okay.
Well, it's a convention rule, so. But I firmly believe that has to be one of the rules.
What odds are you giving it? One of the guys I've talked to said they think it could actually, the balanced budget one could actually be completed as early as next summer.
It could. They're the ones working in it. They know, but they said they're 30 votes away from getting the rest of the states. Unfortunately, some of those 30 votes are leaders, speakers, and majority leaders in the House and Senate that don't want it. They're only one, and they're holding everything up. So I'm not sure how it. I'm not sure if it can get done. What history has shown is that once an issue like this has gotten close, and don't ask me to quote the issues that it did get close on, Congress fixed something that made it go away. So Congress could say, okay, if it got close, we'll have a balanced budget amendment. We'll just adopt a different one. But it'll be like yours, but it will never have the teeth that this one here would have. Congress, for the life of me, I know our congressional delegation, and they're all mixed on whether or not money is the whole issue. Money is the issue for the federal, money and control. And never is today is what was established in the beginning. And so even though we have good delegations there, something happens when they get to Washington.
So it sounds like we'll be talking about it in the legislature, at least.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not going away. Okay. And I'm certainly going to be right there fighting to get it done. I believe if I get anything done while I'm here in Lansing, that could be a solution. It should be a solution I could work on.
If there were a convention, you'd want to go, sounds like.
I would. I probably would not be the brightest and most knowledgeable of the Constitution, but there are some folks around Lansing and around our state that are constitutional experts and believe in what we're doing really seriously. And so probably they would be the ones that would be maybe a better fit for that than just an old lowly state senator.
All right, well, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
You bet, it was a pleasure.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. And thanks to John and Jacob and Lauren for bringing the blueberries. And Adrian, again, thanks a lot. And you know what? The voting by mail thing didn't make your top 10.
It did not.
Yes, okay. I just wanted to make that clear. It would probably have not made mine either, but I just thought I'd go ahead and mention, because
we have acknowledged its existence. I think you've done your duty.
Thank you, Adrian. I appreciate that. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.